Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, a grand appeal to the Muslim world, GM in bankruptcy, and an abortion doctor murdered on a Sunday morning this week. President Obama in Cairo delivered an historic address to the Islamic world.
The people of the world can live together in peace. We know that is God's vision. Now that must be our work here on earth.
The federal government gave General Motors another $30 billion to help it through bankruptcy. Here's GM CEO Fritz Henderson.
This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to recreate and reinvent General Motors. We are immensely grateful for the support of the U.S. taxpayer.
And here's Dr. George Tiller defending his work in abortion in 1991.
What I am doing is legal, what I'm doing is moral, what I'm doing is ethical, and you're not going to run me out of town.
Last Sunday morning, in his Wichita, Kansas church, Dr. Tiller was shot dead, murdered. This hour On Point, our weekly news roundtable, goes behind the headlines. You can join the conversation. Have we seen history made this week? In Cairo? In Detroit? Where do these stories go next? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Tony Blankley, columnist for The Washington Times. He's author of American Grit, What It Will Take to Survive and Win in the 21st Century. Tony, welcome back.
Thank you. Hello.
And joining us from Paris, France, is Christopher Dickey, Newsweek magazine's Middle East regional editor and Paris bureau chief. He's author of Securing the City, Inside America's Best Counterterror Force, the NYPD. Chris Dickey, welcome back to you as well.
Always a pleasure, Tom.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Tony, and Chris.
Big speech by President Obama, of course, in Cairo this week. Let's hear two reactions. Here, speaking with reporters yesterday, House Minority Leader Republican John Boehner said the president was not supporting Israel enough.
With regard to the Palestinian-Israeli issue, he seemed to place equal blame on the Israelis and the Palestinians. I have concerns about this. The Israelis have a right to defend themselves.
No thanks to equal blame, says Boehner. There was a lot of praise for the speech. Some had their issues elsewhere. Here, speaking in Ramallah on the West Bank, Hamas legislator Mahmoud Ramahi said President Barack Obama asked more of the Palestinians in his speech than he did of the Israelis.
Mr. Obama asked Hamas to stop the rockets in the same moment. He didn't speak of anything about 1,500 Palestinians killed in the last invasion of Israel in Gaza.
Reservations there from Hamas. Chris Dickey, this is your beat. What do you make of this? What did you make of the speech, and what do you make of the reaction that you're hearing, feeling across the region and beyond, Chris?
Basically, the people I'm talking to were blown away by the speech. They thought it was very good, very diplomatic, very smart, very well calculated, very well balanced. Sure, your Hamas spokesman is going to say he gave everything to Israel, he didn't give enough to us. Your Israeli spokesman is going to say more or less the same thing in reverse. But the truth is, he struck a very strong line that said that the United States is behind an intelligent, workable peace process that everybody knows is the only game in town. And if you're going to try and get away from that, then you're not really interested in peace. And that was a message that a lot of people have been waiting a long time to hear in this region.
Tony Blankley, you've been very outspoken quite recently against the two-state solution, calling it a mirage. President Obama has this week in Cairo really made it the centerpiece, no bones about it, of American policy, I guess. What do you say, Tony?
Oh, I'm not against it. I'm in favor of a two-state solution. I just don't think it's realistic. I was going to say, I bring to this topic a devout pessimism regarding the possibility of peace anytime soon. So, I mean, in that context, let me say, I think the speech was an excellent exercise in diplomacy. Now, I haven't been in the Middle East as much as Chris, but I've been there many times, and my sense is that the Middle East, and particularly the Arab Middle East, has experienced politicians' words that have disappointed them for so long that they are more cynical about politician words than even we in America and the West are. So I don't know what the deeper impact. Certainly Obama said an awful lot of things that ought to be gratifying to Middle Eastern Muslim sentiment. He said a lot of things that were technically, I think, not supportable, and we can get into those perhaps. But at a high level, and that's what basically Obama's political opponents are doing, are pointing out the various mistakes he made. I tried, as an exercise, to listen to the speech as if it was being delivered by Reagan or Bush, someone I've supported, so as not to be quite as picky about it. And so,
what did you hear, Tony?
It's funny, I heard an awful lot of the same stuff that I'd heard Bush say before about Islam, some of which I did not like and had editorialized against. But I thought there was a lot of continuity in the message. Obviously, a vastly different person delivering the message.
That's really important.
Chris Dickey in Paris, what do you say there?
Well, I think that's really important, the difference in the person delivering the message. Actually, I agree with Tony. There are a lot of the messages that are the same. If you read the text, if you were just reading the text, there would be very strong continuity in the statements about what the policy is. But the message was in the medium of, President Obama. He just comes across as a completely different person with a completely different tone, even though a lot of the substance of what he's saying is basically in continuity with American policy.
Jack Beatty, what do you say about the words, the message, the imagery and symbol of this president in Cairo at this time, this speech?
It seems to me every time he speaks, I'm aware that he does everything possible that words can do. The question is, what can words do? I was greatly impressed by the speech. I read today that the Israeli government is, according to the Jerusalem Post, now facing a great decision. Will Netanyahu essentially stay with the coalition that elected him, or will he try to create a new coalition that where he could say the magic words, the two-state solution, and he could talk about ending settlement expansion? And I note, too, in the Israeli press that something nearly like two-thirds of Israelis now believe that the settlements are an impediment. They're more of an impediment than an asset. The old argument that they were a strategic part of the strategic depth needed to defend Israel proper, that seems to have lost its grip on the Israeli public. And one of the things President Obama has been trying to do in this speech and other speeches is to reach beyond the Netanyahu government to that public and say, look, you put pressure on him to do business with me, and we can do business, leaving unsaid what the alternative is. And whether that means some sort of confrontation with Israel or not, one doesn't know. But it seems to me that strong support from the Israeli citizenry is very encouraging.
Tony Blankley, within hours of the speech, we reached out yesterday across the region, Cairo, Dubai, Abu Dhabi, heard quite positive response. I think I just heard you say that the president was asserting things that were technically not supportable. I'm not sure what you mean by that.
I'll give you an example. When he says, we cannot impose peace, but privately, many Muslims recognize that Israel will not go away. Likewise, many Israelis recognize the need for a Palestinian state. It's time for us to act on what everyone knows to be true. Well, the polling data, the Pew did a huge global attitude study in 2007, country by country. Palestinians, by 77% to 16%, do not believe the existence of Israel is consistent with their interests. And 61% of Israelis do believe that Palestinian state is consistent with their interests. So it's not the case that similar numbers. The problem that the president and any peacemaker faces is that about 8 in 10, not only Palestinians, but Egyptians and Saudis and other nations of Islam in the Middle East, about 8 out of 10 are opposed to Israel's right to exist. So that makes it very hard to get an agreement.
No, that's not exactly what those polls are saying. That's not what those polls are saying. If the question is Israel commensurate with the interests of the Palestinians, I don't think it's very easy to find Palestinians in the occupied territories who would think that's true. When you've got hundreds and hundreds of checkpoints in the Palestinian territories that people have to deal with every day, guess what? When they're polled, they're not going to see those as basically congruent with their interests.
Well, look, I mean,
that's pretty obvious.
The poll, is authoritative, and I've never seen any poll inconsistent with the proposition.
It's a question of what the context is.
Let's hear from the president himself, if we may. Of course, he moved on to... to Germany. I'm sorry, Chris, but I want to get a little bit of tape in here before the break. Of course, the president's gone on to visit the Nazi death camp at Buchenwald, first American president to do that. Also, strong symbolism in the wake of the Cairo visit. Speaking in Germany today with the German Chancellor Angela Merkel at his side, he elaborated on why he was pushing Israel to solve its dispute with the Palestinians.
As Israel's friend, the United States, I think, has an obligation to just be honest with that friend about how important it is to achieve a two-state solution.
And then he spoke also about Israeli and Palestinian moves in the standoff.
The moment is now for us to act on what we all know to be the truth, which is that each side is going to have to make some difficult compromises. We have to reject violence. The Palestinians have to get serious about creating the security environment that is required for Israel to feel confident. Israelis are going to have to take some difficult steps.
Chris Dickey in Paris, we have just a half a minute before the break. We'll talk more, but in a word, do you see the real possibility of a breakthrough here or rhetoric and who knows?
Yeah, I think there's a real possibility. Whether it will happen, I don't know. But all the stars are lining up, as it were, for all the Arabs and the Palestinians to try and seize this moment. If they don't, well, then they will have missed yet another opportunity.
Well, a big speech. And, Jack, it did have the feeling of history. An American president making remarks in Arabic there, reaching out. And, it, you know, the middle name is Hussein. And we heard Muslims responding to that yesterday, the kind of globalization that once again embodied in this guy.
Absolutely. And, you know, the advantage of that to our diplomacy, I just think, can't be quantified. I mean, it's not just a change in image. It's something more.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Obama in Egypt, GM in bankruptcy, a dead doctor in Kansas, a French airliner down in the Atlantic. Tony Blankley is with us from the Washington Times. Christopher Dickey, Paris Bureau Chief and Middle East Regional Editor for Newsweek, is here from Paris. Jack Beatty's here. Let's get a call from Kenny in Heartland, Vermont. Kenny, you are on the air.
How are you today?
Pretty good.
My concern, it was a terrific speech. He gives a great speech. But I am so tired of him going out and apologizing to the world for America. You know, we're the greatest country, you know, that's ever come down the pike. We've made mistakes. You know, we waterboarded three people. But that does not make us a bad country. And I'm so tired of apologizing. I know Jack loves to apologize, you know, for America. And it's I find it very frustrating.
Kenny, let me just ask you as a practical matter, pragmatically, if we've got a problem with public opinion in the Muslim world, and if that problem is costing us in wars and terrorism, you know, might it, just practically speaking, be worth some outreach? Do we have to see it as apology?
You can do it by pointing out the good thing, the great things we've done for Muslims over the years. You know, Bosnia is an excellent
yep.
example
mm-hmm.
of where we went to bat for Muslims. And, you know, in the long run, it looks like Iraq may be turning around. You know, if it does, I mean, you know, it was clumsy getting to where we are. But if it turns around and it becomes, you know, a democratic society over there, isn't that a good thing? I mean, you know, we've never gone over there to colonize. He mentioned colonization yesterday. We've never gone over there to colonize anybody.
I guess the region certainly has known colonizers. But, Kenny, let us pick that up. You say tired of apology, and your view was echoed. This is earlier in this week. Let me play something right here and think about the politics of this. Here's former GOP presidential hopeful Mitt Romney taking President Obama to task this week for what he described as his tone in recent speeches abroad. And this was Monday, before the Cairo speech, at the Heritage Foundation. Let's listen. Romney says America doesn't owe the world any apologies.
With all due respect, I take issue with President Obama's recent tour of apology. It's not because America hasn't made mistakes. We have. But because America's mistakes are overwhelmed by what America has meant to the hopes and aspirations of people throughout the world. The president also claimed on Arabic TV that America has dictated to other nations. No, America has sacrificed to free other nations from dictators.
I'll come to everyone on this, but Tony Blankley, first to you. You hear Kenny's lament in Vermont, and there's Mitt Romney. What about the complaint itself? And then what about the politics? Is this a line that the GOP can successfully ride? Does this play broadly in this country for the Republicans, Tony?
I don't think it's a strategic message engagement. I think most Americans probably don't like to hear the country run down or apologized for. So it and neither do I. But I don't think it's going to be a strategic failure for Obama to make these concessions. I'm more concerned, maybe we'll talk about it at some other time, the various statements he made that I don't think even as at a words level work. I mean, for instance, when he says that we won't presume to tell people what's best for everyone, and then we say, but he has unyielding belief that all people want, among things, equal administration of justice. Well, the Sharia law gives an unequal administration of justice between men and women. So it seems to be, I don't know how Muslims will hear these speeches, these words. They don't make sense to my understanding.
Christopher Dickey in Paris, how do you hear our caller Kenny in Vermont? How do you hear Mitt Romney with this allegation, tour of apology at the president?
Well, you know, I wrote a column in Newsweek online at the beginning of the week saying, you know, should Obama apologize for America's history, and should there be apologies between Israel and Hamas and these other groups? And probably at some point, everybody needs to acknowledge that there have been terrible mistakes made on all sides. And whether acknowledgement is the same as apology, I don't think so. And I think what Obama did in the speech was to go very far toward acknowledging a lot of problems, but not to apologize, not to say, I'm sorry to be an American. Far from it. The speech was about, I'm proud to be an American, and it's a great example for everybody else. And I think that what he was trying to do on the issue of democracy was to say, look, we have our system. It works very well for us. We cannot go and transpose that onto other countries around the world. But we can say there are things to learn from the American experience that everybody can take home. And those have to do with rule of law, responsibility of government, transparency, all those kinds of issues that we associate with a good working political system. And that's the message he was trying to get across. The idea that we can go throw out a dictator and create a new government in our mold is probably not a very good idea. And while things may eventually work out in Iraq, it will have been after years and years of spending $2.5 billion a week to make that happen and hundreds of thousands of people dead, which is probably not the best deal in the world.
And we still don't know. There were definitely words of reconciliation, also tough words, in the president's speech.
In Ankara, I made clear that America is not and never will be at war with Islam. We will, however, relentlessly confront violent extremists who pose a grave threat to our security. Because we reject the same thing that people of all faiths reject, the killing of innocent men, women, and children. And it is my first duty as president to protect the American people.
Let's go to Alkaloo, South Carolina, and Mary Ellen. Mary Ellen, you're on the air.
Yes, hello, Tom.
Hi.
I want to make a few comments concerning Tony Blankley and his comments thus far.
Okay.
I find that he's quite a negative naysayer, and perhaps that's why you put him on, to give an alternative side. But I will say that since he went ahead and told us that indeed he is a Reagan-Bush person, it's not surprising, but they've had 8 years or more to offer alternatives. And what I would appreciate from Tony Blankley is to hear some positive remarks, because the next 8 years better be something positive happening, and thus far, this is our best hope. And I'll take my response off the air.
Mary Ellen, thank you very much. Tony, have you got a sunny side?
On lots of topics, but I, you know, if I dissent from policy, as certainly Obama had a right to dissent from Bush's policy, and he was negative about Bush's policy, he had every right to do so. He may have been right. We'll find out. I don't think the caller. I'm not sure how the caller understands our process in America, that you need to be positive about whatever particular politician who's in power. I mean, I support policies that make sense and oppose policies that don't make sense. And I did that with Bush, too. In both my books, I criticized Bush severely for elements of his policy. So I think dissent is healthier than suppression of dissent.
Let's go to Austin, Texas, and John. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Well.
I just like to suggest that the U.S. Stop giving billions of dollars a year in aid to Israel, and perhaps if they do so, Israel will finally be forced to come to terms with peace with the Palestinians as a matter of survival.
Straight up, cut it off. I mean, you heard the president say again and again that Israel is a stone deep ally of the United States. He's not talking cut off of aid. He's pushing for things, but cut it off?
Is it a matter of necessity that to have Israel as an ally, we fund to the tune of billions of dollars a year policies that we don't agree with?
John, thanks for your call. Jack Beatty, let's think for a minute about billions and allies in this region. Of course, Egypt is the number two recipient there, and Mr. Mubarak, no Jeffersonian Democrat. How do you look at American alliances and dollars in the context of Obama's speech, Jack?
Well, I'm wondering whether the president has misdiagnosed the threat to American security from that region. He seems to define it as coming from the Israel-Palestinian conflict. And certainly there's a great deal of tension there and spillover into antagonism toward America. But what do we learn after 9/11? We learned that the main problem, according to expert after expert we had on this show, was the regime, Saudi Arabia and Egypt, and their repression. That's where the terrorists came from. The connection between tyranny and terrorism is empirical. In Egypt, you see a country with 80,000 political prisoners. Its security force has a larger budget than its budget for health care. The security force is nearly four times the size of the army. Recently, two years ago, an Egyptian blogger in the Washington Post wrote, "How much is enough to make Americans question why their money goes to support this government? We Egyptians want a fair struggle for our freedom. We'll never have it so long as Mubarak and his corrupt regime are propped up by U.S. aid." Similar things could be said in Saudi Arabia. And the question is, cutting off aid to Israel, what about aid to these two countries? What about the $30 billion in military aid that has gone to Egypt? And is that, what about putting conditions on that aid? Isn't that the place where the terrorism began? And shouldn't our foreign policy, looking toward our own interests, be directed to transforming our relations to those regimes?
There's a lot mixed up here. Chris Dickey, I want to hear you on that. Let me get a couple of calls first from Des Moines, Iowa. John, you're on the air, John.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
This selective amnesia about apologies and that America is lily white. I mean, we pretty much committed genocide on Native Americans and built this country on the back of slaves. I think a mature person or a mature country would apologize when they're wrong. America is not lily white. We do have some skeletons in our closet, and I think the torture issue shows that we do have some apologizing to do.
A mature country.
I'll take my comments off the air.
Yeah, we got it. A mature country ready to apologize when it's appropriate. Let's get one more right here from Montreal, Canada, and Ahmed. Ahmed, you're on the air.
Yes, hello, Tom. Yeah. I just before I give my point about concerning Obama's speech, I just want to give concerning the job that the speaker said about Sharia law not being equal for men and women. Mm-hmm. If a person actually studies it and makes some effort to find out, it is very equal for men and women. Concerning the Obama speech itself, I do appreciate the handout and concerning trying to make a peace between the Islamic mm-hmm. world and the Western world. Mm-hmm. I do appreciate that. But just one point is that currently the countries that America is actually bombing or attacking is Iraq, Afghanistan. We have the Palestinian issue now, maybe Pakistan, maybe Iran. All these countries happen to be Muslim countries. North Korea set off two nuclear bombs, no reaction. Iran is following the agreement, the non-proliferation agreement, yet we're always against them. And this happens to be all Muslim countries. So when we say America is not at war with Islam, the action doesn't say so. But I do appreciate the handout, and I hope it goes more than just words.
Ahmed, thank you very much for your call. Chris Dickey in Paris, here again. You know the region. You hear our observation from John in Des Moines about a mature nation and times for apology. Ahmed saying the words are nice and he appreciates them, but there are American soldiers and military goals in Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan. And Chris, you hear Jack Beatty saying, well, maybe it's these autocratic regimes that are the real problem, not so much the Israel-Palestinian conflict. I know that's a lot, Chris, but dive in.
First of all, why does Egypt get all that aid? It gets all that aid because it made peace with Israel. Its aid is a direct function of policy toward Israel. That's just the way it is. It's not because we love to support dictators. It's because the United States government has taken the position that it supports countries, including dictators, that make peace with Israel. That's what that aid is about. So I think we ought to be clear. And what Obama is trying to do is look at the whole picture and say, yes, things are interrelated, and they're interrelated in very comprehensible ways. You can't detach one message from another. You can't say, oh, the problem is all these dictators that we support, but the problem is not Israel and Palestine. No, it's all part of the peace. But the biggest challenge for the American policy in the region is Iran. And what Iran understands very, very well is that the question of Israel and Palestine is the most potent political issue in the region, even for people who don't actually like Palestinians, who don't really want to go and fight against Israel. It's still an emotional, potent political issue that Iran exploits very well. So if you address the Israeli-Palestinian issue, then you can start to address questions of democracy and human rights. Then you can start to address Iran, all not exactly at the same time. You can sequence it, but they're all interrelated.
Jack, how about it that, yes, problems, but it comes back here particularly in regard to Iran and the fuel that has, in part, driven its ascent?
Well, there's no question about that this is a tremendous propaganda advantage to Iran and to others who would wish the United States ill. I'm just drawing attention to what happened historically and to the etiology of the September 11th attacks and to the role that America's support of these regimes played in those attacks and to the deftness with which the regimes have targeted antagonism toward themselves, toward America, even in Egypt today. And none of these questions have been dealt with, it seems to me. The question of conditionality has been dropped. The Bush administration dropped its emphasis on democracy. Maybe wisely, we don't know. But you could easily imagine a situation where working toward a peace with Israel-Palestine, a settlement there, we made even further concessions to these regimes. After all, we're going to need their help and further entrench them. So, yes, all things are related, but what is primary, what is secondary, I don't know.
We'll get to GM. Tony, just 30 seconds before the break, Israel-Palestinians as the heart of the knot of problems in this region. Do you see it that way in a word?
Well, it certainly is the focal point. I mean, obviously, Arab states, Jordan, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, have been very happy to have the Palestinians and the Jews fighting. It takes the attention away from their own misfeasance. And it's absolutely correctly the case that one of the greatest grievances that bin Laden has against America is supporting the indigenous tyrannical regimes in the Middle East above Muslims. So they're both part of the bigger truth.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. An airliner down, a martial arts movie star dead, and a new Tonight Show this week. Air France Flight 447, bound for Paris from Rio, vanished over the Atlantic. A grieving Patricia Coakley waited in vain for her passenger husband, Arthur.
I kept phoning him on his mobile. Yesterday it was ringing. So maybe they're not at the bottom of the sea. That's my hope, but I think it's maybe fading today.
It's hard to hear. Many sympathies there. Actor David Carradine was found dead in a Bangkok hotel. He starred in Kill Bill, but was known for his 1970s TV show, Kung Fu.
Master, how does one find the strength within himself?
By being one with all that is without himself. Where the tiger and the man are two, Grasshopper, he may die.
And on Monday, Jay Leno was out and Conan O'Brien started his new job as host of The Tonight Show.
I think I've timed this moment perfectly. Think about it. I'm on a last place network. I moved to a state that's bankrupt, and tonight's show is sponsored by General Motors.
We're looking at a week in the news. GM in bankruptcy, a dead doctor in Kansas, the French airliner down in the Atlantic. We've been joined by Christopher Dickey, Newsweek's Paris bureau chief and Middle East regional editor, author of Securing the City. Tony Blankley is with us from the Washington Times, author of American Grit. Jack Beeney's here as well, and you can join us. President Obama, sort of in the middle of a lot of things this week, here he is talking about the federal government and General Motors. It's filed for bankruptcy. The government has a 60% stake in the company. He said GM will be run by a private board of directors.
They, and not the government, will call the shots and make the decisions about how to turn this company around. The federal government will refrain from exercising its rights as a shareholder in all but the most fundamental corporate decisions. When a difficult decision has to be made on matters like where to open a new plant or what type of new car to make, the new GM, not the United States government, will make that decision. In short, our goal is to get GM back on its feet, take a hands-off approach, and get out quickly.
Get out quick, says the president. There are skeptics. Here's Republican Senator Jim DeMint of South Carolina on Wednesday saying the government intervention with General Motors is very troubling.
Now the government is picking winners and losers. We just as well should rename General Motors Fannie Motors. What's happening here is outrageous. We're crossing all kinds of constitutional lines. TARP and the TARP bill we passed did not authorize this kind of activity. The Constitution does not allow the federal government to do what we're seeing here today. We have an out-of-control government that we need to somehow rein in.
Christopher Dickey in Paris, it might be interesting to hear your view of this first. I mean, you're in Europe. Governments there involved in many ways, a little different stripe of capitalism than we've had in the United States. Now, something unusual going on here. How are you? How's Europe looking at what's going on with Washington and GM?
Well, I think it's looking at it as the sort of the Europeanization of the United States. And some people in the United States probably look at that as, with horror. But, in fact, the Europeans look at the situation and they say, you know, these are things that need to be done. The United States had the most laissez-faire system that could possibly exist, and it was incredibly dynamic and allowed for huge growth, but it also allows for huge crashes with very little cushion. So what we've seen in the United States over the last few months is a scramble to create some kind of cushion, not only for unemployed people and the grand public, but in fact for the corporations themselves. And all of that is going to take some sorting out. But I don't think the Europeans are really appalled at all by what they're seeing. I think they see it as kind of inevitable.
Tony Blankley, GM, absolutely staggering here. Here comes the cushion. They say they'll work out of this. How do you look at it, Tony?
Well, I look with horror at the thought of American economy becoming European. I mean, they've sustained, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12% unemployment rates as a steady basis. That's, you know, their policies. I prefer American dynamism. There's no doubt at all that as long as the federal government has a substantial interest in a corporation, it's going to be managing it. Good heavens, Obama fired the CEO of General Motors before they'd even legally taken it over. Yesterday, Senator Rockefeller was holding hearings complaining about which dealerships Chrysler was closing down. Of course, you're going to have politicians making political decisions regarding companies that the taxpayers have assets in. That's why we should keep away from that kind of policy and let the bankruptcy courts function. GM's not going to be a better managed company when it's run by politicians. It's been badly run by the private sector and deserves to be where it is in the bankruptcy court, regretfully, but it's not going to be more efficiently managed by the politicians.
Jack Beeney, what do you see unfolding here?
Well, I mean, it seems to me that the cushion is justified broadly as a public policy, just strictly on anti-cyclical grounds. Imagine if the administration had let GM go into bankruptcy, if it had been liquidated, if it had, you would have had, I've seen estimates of 60, 70,000 unemployed all across the industrial Midwest. So I think that's just justified as part of our stimulus. Now, it may well be fortuitous for General Motors to have gone bankrupt in a recession, because I think that does increase the argument from public policy to do something. But that's the fact. And then second, what about the industrial policy? I think Tony is right. There are these problems. But it does strike me that in a week when you have people like David Brooks saying, oh, this corporate culture there is toxic, nothing good can ever come out of General Motors, the government will now be deeply involved. When you have all that coming from people like him, and then you have David Leonhardt in the New York Times citing ISH Global Insight, a research firm. They looked into the numbers, and what did they see? Well, within a couple of years, they think GM, Government Motors, General Motors, could make a small profit. By 2014, it's likely to be quite profitable, according to this consultancy. Now, who knows? But I do think the question is, you know, maybe even over the longer term, this can work. If you have a consultancy looking at the numbers and leaving ideology out, they come to that judgment. Maybe there's some chance here.
We've got to call Ron in Augusta. But, Ron, listen with us first before we bring you. Here's General Motors Chief Financial Officer Ray Young this week promising to turn the company around.
But we're going to be very much focused as a product and customer-oriented company. A lot of investments in this era in terms of advanced technologies. Our intent is to return this investment by the American taxpayers, both in terms of the loan that they'll be providing to us, as well as the shares that the American public will initially own in the new General Motors.
We will pay it back, says the GM CFO, Ron, in Augusta, Georgia. You're on the air, Ron.
Yeah, thank you very much for taking my call.
Yeah.
I guess what I've been reading is that the whole paradigm needs to change. If you look at what has become political, it's the dealer network. If you look at what's become political, it's the number of jobs. And I think that if you look at our new paradigm, which basically people are saying, look, I don't want five dealers. I want to go online. I want to pick my car out, and I want it delivered to my house, just like Amazon. I'm going to pay the best price. I'm going to get the best car. And the showrooms basically are where I can go drive the car with no pressure, with no sales, with no anything. I'll get the best price. I just want to be able to sell, to be able to not worry about the car. I want to try the car. I want to get the information about the car. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the things that's going to make these companies more profitable.
Ron, what's your assessment or your gut feeling? Do you think GM will be back and profitable on its feet and having paid back the billions the U.S. government is now putting in?
If they don't change their paradigm, if they make cars that are unaffordable and people don't really want, then I don't think they can be, because there's so much more competition. There's no big three anymore.
Yeah, Ron, thank you very much for your call in Augusta. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke talking this week about the amount of federal spending going on. And, of course, he has supported it to push back against the collapse that began last year. But this week he was saying, telling the House Banking Committee that deficit created in the years we've been in and recently is going to have to be confronted soon.
Maintaining the confidence of the financial markets requires that we as a nation begin planning now for the restoration of fiscal balance. Clearly, the Congress and the administration face formidable near-term challenges that must be addressed. But those near-term challenges must not be allowed to hinder timely consideration of the steps needed to address fiscal imbalances. Unless we demonstrate a strong commitment to fiscal sustainability in the longer term, we will have neither financial stability nor healthy economic growth.
Big warning this week, Jack, from Ben Bernanke, saying he has said we've got to do this spending. Now he's saying we also have to hit the brakes, and pretty soon.
Yes, of course, some people are saying, well, he's someone to talk, having flooded the economy with currency, but as part of his emergency task. You know, there's some speculation that he is acting here as a front man for the Treasury, and that what he's really doing is saying to the Congress, look, the president made a mere $19 billion in cuts, he recommended, and everyone up there said, oh, we can't do any of that, and all the special interests came out. And now, of course, they're thinking of vastly expanding health insurance, and without seeming any way to pay for it. And I think what he's sort of saying is, you better think about ways to pay for it, because if you don't, we're going to have this problem with we're going to continue to borrow. We'll be spending more in interest charges than we are in anything else. And that's not sustainable.
I want to turn to the Dr. Tiller murder in Wichita, Kansas. But Chris Dickey and Paris, to you, just before we do, Tony Blankley sort of horrified at Europe's 8, 9, 10% unemployment, doesn't want to go down that road. Do you see woe and misery down Europe's road?
France's unemployment right now is lower than American unemployment. I mean, and when you're unemployed in France, you're still a consumer. You're not suffering. And for a long time, that's just a horrible thing, that you could be unemployed in Europe and you weren't suffering. Therefore, you wouldn't go out and get another job. Well, now we've got higher unemployment in the United States and people are suffering and they're not consuming. And when they're not consuming, they're not helping to drive the economy. That's one of the essential differences between the European and the American economy.
Let's get a call here from John in Cambridge, Massachusetts. John, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. I was just calling about the George Tiller murder, and I'm struck by, you know, obviously the overall tragedy of the murder, but I think what makes it doubly tragic is the quickness with which this is seized upon as having a broader political meaning, especially as we learn about this man's apparent mental illness. And, you know, even this station has referred to him as an anti-abortion crusader. And I think it's just there's more sort of a finer granularity to what's going on here. I think both sides, when this happened in terms of the political debate, kind of groaned. And
But do you really think this is not a random killing? I mean, how can it not be seen in a political context, John?
That's probably inevitable. But it's you know, I think that the man's mental illness certainly has to be a factor in this. And you know, I don't know if you can connect the dots to this man and a broader political agenda from a pro-life side, I guess is what I'm saying.
Well, you can certainly connect the killing to, I would think, to messages that have been out there, very hard messages, and for a long time. Here's one of Tiller's biggest critics, just for example, Fox News' Bill O'Reilly in 2008.
No matter what you think about the abortion issue, you should be very disturbed by what continues to happen in Kansas. This man, Dr. George Tiller, known as Tiller the Baby Killer, is performing late-term abortions without defining the specific medical reasons why. Let's be more blunt. Tiller is executing fetuses in his Wichita clinic for $5,000, and records show he'll do it for vague medical reasons. That is, he'll kill the fetus viable outside the womb if the mother wants it dead.
Bill O'Reilly in 2008. In 2009, Dr. Tiller is dead. I'm reading here Judith Warner of the New York Times talking about some of the women, that's not even the word here, that he's helped, 9-year-old girl who had been raped by her father. She was 18 weeks pregnant. The OBGYN, Dr. George Tiller, helped her. Jack Beatty, talk about, I mean, I don't know how you avoid the political. After all, you know, this man was hunted. Now he's dead. Dead in the foyer of his church.
Yeah, a ghastly matter, and it's true. Ron is right. The assassin's mental illness certainly you can't make a direct connection, but the climate of hate and the climate of abuse. You know, for example, just simply using the word murder for abortion. Well, it's not murder. I mean, the law. You know, murder is a civil offense. That is not what abortion is, and just routinely in discussion, people use that word, and it's just simply wrong. And then you know, his clinic. You know, our colleague Robin Young had a show on Here and Now interviewing a woman who'd gone out there facing a terrible dilemma. She had wanted a child, married, did everything. This terribly deformed fetus. What was to be done? Finally, the only thing to be done was to go there and have this done. And she went to the waiting room and met, you know, two or three other women just like her who longed for their children, who desperately wanted them, and who now face this terrible decision. Do I give birth to, first of all, an infant that will feel terrible pain, that will die immediately, that I may be severely malformed as a result? I mean, look, what he was doing was, in fact, legal and protected by our Constitution, and he was protecting many of these women.
We're not going to solve that one this week, but I can't let the week pass without some memory of this. June 4th, 1989, archival sound of government troops in China on Tiananmen Square, Beijing. And on Sunday, thousands of protesters in Hong Kong asking the Chinese government to acknowledge that event. One of the protesters, Li Chuk-yun.
Without validity on June 4, it showed that Chinese government do not have any sincerity in pushing forward political reform with respect of human rights and democracy. So we hope by marching, we give this very clear message to the Chinese government. We want change. We want democracy.
Not much mention of Tiananmen in this country on this anniversary. Chris Dickey, what about in Europe? Are they looking at China through the prism of Tiananmen, or is that now overshadowed by economics and power and everything else?
Oh, I think there's been a lot of specials on television and newspapers about Tiananmen. Everybody's marking the anniversary, but in kind of a perfunctory way. I think the question is, are the Chinese marking this anniversary? And a lot of the reports that have come out here suggest that the generation that's grown up since then, the ones who were not born or who were 5 or 10 years old then, aren't really focused on the kinds of issues that we think about when we think about Tiananmen.
History rolling, but we remember for a moment. There's a lot to remember. There are a lot of history, further back than 1989. That's it for this week. What a big week. Chris Dickey in Paris with Newsweek. We're always grateful to have you. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Tony Blankley with The Washington Times. Thank you very much for being here as well.
Delighted to be here. Thank you.
Jack Beatty, have a great weekend. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.